It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Room & Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Well, today we talk with a hiker and journalist. David Plotnikoff was into a classic midlife crisis, so he did what any of us would do. He set out to trek 2,650 miles from Mexico to Canada along the Pacific Crest Trail to sort out his thinking. Well, his food was just fuel. That's it. Or so he thought. Sculptor Kiko Denzer sings the glories of mud and how to build your own bread oven from your own dirt. Ruth Reichel of Gourmet Magazine fame tells us her picks for great summer reads. We get the skinny on how to store that haul from the farmer's market. Russ Parsons knows what to refrigerate and what will be ruined by the chill. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's get the show rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, where do we begin singing the praises of Jewelerette's in Harbor Springs, Michigan? Do we talk about the planked whitefish?
Yes.
Or do we talk about the most Midwestern thing I was ever served, which is green pea and peanut salad in Miracle Whip? I mean, if that isn't just
that
essence.
That is truly a dying art.
Yes.
And they're still doing this?
The composed salad. Yes, they're still doing it. It's part of a repertoire of real kind of Northern Midwestern hot dish, cold composed salad foods that you don't find elsewhere.
The other thing with this place, it's kind of, you know, I feel like I'm jumping all over the map, but in a way that's the soul of Jewelerette's. You can also get probably the best old-fashioned ice cream, soda, sundae, banana split. And they're famous for something called the Thundercloud, which is vanilla ice cream, bittersweet chocolate sauce, chopped nuts in one of those wonderful slender tulip glasses with a big blob of marshmallow fluff on the top. So pea salad, fish, and a thundercloud. I don't know.
And the place itself, we have to say, it's a summertime place. It's not open in the winter. It's you know, Harbor Springs is a very popular resort for Michiganders and others. And so it's got that wonderful resort town feel about it. You go there in the evening in the summer and like kids are table hopping, adults are table hopping. People go in and out and greet each other. It's sort of like a little town meeting place.
What does it look like? I mean, is it like a porch? Is it...
It looks old-fashioned. You have to remember that in 1923, the song Sleepy Time Gal was written there.
In case you forgot.
You know, need we say that it's old-fashioned? It's got sort of, it's like a dining room slash ice cream parlor slash summer eating place. I mean, it's not ramshackle at all, but it is old fashioned.
But we haven't even talked about the planked Lake Superior whitefish, which is the primary reason to go to Jewelerette's. Now, do you know what we're talking about when we say planked whitefish?
Yeah, but I think you ought to explain it.
Okay, it's a bunch of whitefish fillets on a cedar plank. It's surrounded by a wall of mashed potatoes. The mashed potatoes shore in the juices of the fish, the lemon juice, and all the butter that the fish gets cooked with. And the fish is just what it's that kind of moist, milky, freshwater, delicious flavor. The potatoes are wonderful. The combination of the potatoes, the fish, the lemon juice, and the butter is just one of those summertime treats that is without peer.
Protected whitefish is really what you could call this.
Yes, it's whitefish in a fort.
Where is Harbor Springs?
Way up north. Near the what are the straits? Straits of Mackinac.
Near Petoskey.
Right. It's north of Petoskey. It's in. You know what else is great about it is that it's practically in Michigan cherry country. So that if you're on your way to or from Jewelerette's, you can stop at one of those roadside stands and get the most delicious dark summer cherries you will ever eat.
Sounds fabulous, guys.
It is fabulous.
Thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes... makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Dana Michael Stern's latest book is Road Food Sandwiches. Now, the Sterns check in with us every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. If ever there was a time to save your stale bread, it is now. Saving that bread saved our Sunday lunch. We had some friends over to help us decide on house paint colors, and all of a sudden it was noon, and we were five for lunch. I had figured a big salad, some sliced tomatoes, and leftover salmon would do the job, except that we'd been eating like wolves all weekend. And I mean, I could actually see the back of our refrigerator. Now, this never happens. So there was no lettuce. There was no leftovers except the salmon. And the tomatoes were really sparse, and it was too hot to think about cooking. But there on the counter was a bag of leftover bread. I mean, it was more like rocks from the Cro-Magnon period. So anyway, what I did was this basic Mediterranean salad thing. This is how you do it. You soak the pieces of bread in cold water and vinegar. Then you scrounge for any vegetable that you can find. Now, I had some Walla Walla onions, the really sweet kind, and that was enough to bulk out the tomatoes. I also had fresh basil. Now, to make up for so few tomatoes, I decided to throw another taste into the dish. I toasted whole cumin seed with sliced garlic. And then I mash that all with some olive oil and basil. So now this is how the salad goes together. You squeeze out the bread, you chop up the vegetables, you mix that together. I threw in the cumin and the garlic, and then I added oil, vinegar, salt, and pepper to taste. And it saved the lunch. So don't let that bread go to waste. The staler, the better. When you bring a community together, at least in the past, you have to include the bread oven. We were just in Spain, and sure enough, in a tiny mountain village, there it was in the place of honor, the village square, right beside the other necessity of life, the well. Now, I dream of those neighborhood baking days with my own wood-fired oven. You know, the glorious breads, the pizzas, the roast fish. And then things get tacky. A wood-fired oven can run $10,000. Well, sculptor Kiko Denzer has a completely different take on this. 6 years ago, he came out with a book on how to build your own bread oven with what you've got in your yard, mud. And he's been building them with kids and adults all over the country. Well, Kiko has updated his book. It's called Build Your Own Earth Oven. Kiko, welcome back.
Thanks, Lynn. It's nice to be here.
Could you walk us through the basics of building an oven?
Sure. The best way to start is to sort of go through the history of ovens and fire, because, of course, you know, the first thing people did was they just built a fire and put bread in the coals.
Mm-hmm.
But the history of ovens is basically a hot fire and a flat rock to basically a little hole in the ground. So the best first step is to just take a few bricks, make a pile of sand on the bricks, and then cover the sand with mud, cut a hole in the dome that you make, and put a fire in it, and let it get hot. And then once it's hot, you can put in a little focaccia or a little pizza or some cookies or whatever. And you can literally make one of those in a half an hour, and you don't need a book, and you don't need anything special, and you can do it with your kids, and they'll get all excited just to make cookies in their own little oven. But once you've done that, it won't hold heat very long, and you can't cook a lot in it. Mm-hmm. So you build a little bit bigger one. And then you can keep a little fire on the side if you want to cook pizza, or it'll hold enough heat to cook some bread or a chicken or whatever else you have. But again, you know, after a while, you realize either it's not big enough or it doesn't hold heat long enough, and then you're ready to make a larger commitment, so you build a foundation to get it up off the ground.
Now, I'm just trying to picture this. First of all, I want to just go back to the beginning. When you make that mound of sand and then you put mud over it, that mound of sand is just to help the mud dry into a hollow shape, right? And then you pull the sand out.
Right. That's right. The mold.
Right. It's that's the mold. And that, no matter what your oven is, that's where you always begin, is with the mold.
Right.
Right.
It's the shape of the void.
Right.
So then, Lynn, once you've played around with your little ovens and you're confident about your materials, then you can go ahead and build your deluxe model, which, of course, you want to raise up to a good working height, which is usually about waist high. So then you build a platform. And the platform can be, you know, anything from a couple of stout sawhorses to a stack of logs to railroad ties, you know, a super fancy, beautiful brick or stone. And then you have a plinth and you build your oven on top of that. So you put your layer of insulation down, right, because you want to isolate the masonry so it holds heat. You build the oven on top of that layer of insulation and then you wrap it with more insulation, which is just, it's basically the same material, except that instead of mixing it with sand, you mix it with sawdust or straw or anything lightweight. And then you put a finish plaster on it. And that's your basic oven. And that in itself is a beautiful sculpture. It's just, you know, the shape is lovely and round. It's like half of an egg. But if you want to make a sculpture, you know, if you want a fire-breathing dragon or a a duck or a face or whatever, you can sculpt onto it whenever you're inspired. You know, once you've finished the basic oven, you don't have to do it all right away. You can do it in phases. And then you've got your full-size oven, and you can cook anything in it that you want. After you've done your pizza and flatbread and sourdough breads, which all need high temperatures, then as the heat declines, you can cook meat, fish, vegetables, soup, stew, stock. You can incubate your yogurt. You can dry your shoes.
Do anything you want,
right? Yeah. Then when you're done with your cooking, there will still be residual heat in the oven. And the best way to use the oven is to make sure you use all the heat, right? Because
right,
if you've burnt all that wood and stored all the heat in the oven, you want to get the most out of it. So at the end, what we do is we stuff our oven full of wood for the next firing, because even dry wood will hold 10 or 15% moisture, depending on where you are. And the more of that moisture you can drive out before you go and fire your oven the next time, the faster and hotter it will heat.
I have a feeling that we're going to see a spate of ovens going up in my neighborhood.
Well, my hope is, Lynn, like in Spain, that the neighborhood will rally around the ovens they built, you know. It's not an oven for every house. It's an oven for every neighborhood because,
yes,
it, you know,
yeah,
it is a community,
yeah,
hearth. And that's, I
exactly,
think, the greatest value.
Kiko, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Lynn.
Fire it up. Fire it up. We push. Kiko Denzer is author of Build Your Own Earth Oven. Now, for more information, go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to register for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and get information on our podcasts, as well as our new book, How to Eat Supper. You can find everything you're ever going to need at splendidtable.org. Coming up, the guy who hiked from Mexico to Canada on a diet that could kill a goat, and great summer reads for cooks. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Room & Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. One man, 2,650 miles, and only food enough to fill a single knapsack. Well, the man is San Francisco journalist David Plotnikoff. He reached that point in life where you question what you have done that is really of any value. His solution lay in 3 summers of hiking the entire Pacific Crest Trail from Mexico to Canada. It would separate, he says, the essential from the trivial. David, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for having me on.
David, had you done a lot of hiking before you decided to take this on?
I had done short segments of the Pacific Crest Trail, but nothing even approaching this scale.
Why did you decide to do this alone?
I think it would be unfair to depress any of my friends into service to ask them to walk 20 miles a day, to ask them to carry 15 pounds of water on their backs. They've got a very different fix on what it takes to recreate than I do. I didn't know anybody who would define that as fun.
Yeah, I think I can identify with that. Now, you say in the piece you wrote for Savoir magazine that you did this to clear your mind. Did this happen in the way that you thought it would?
It happened very gradually, and this is one of the great paradoxes of being out on the trail doing 20 miles a day for months on end. The longer that you are out there for and the further you're going, the less you carry. And this extended to mental baggage as well. I found once I was through the first 200 or 300 miles down through the Mojave Desert, I found myself really thinking less and less about all the external white noise of the world out there. The totality of what's on your mind is, how much water do I have?
Mm-hmm.
How far do I have to walk today? How hot is it going to be? And, of course, what am I going to eat? except for the occasional bear, of whom I saw four on the trail altogether, up close and personal, except for bears, mountain lions, that sort of thing, it was really it was an exercise in winnowing away the trivial, and it snuck up on me. But by the time I got further up the trail into the Sierra Nevada, I think I was mentally in the moment 100%. And that remained that way all the way through Canada.
What happened to your sensibility about food through all of this?
Well, I had begun looking at food very dispassionately. Prior to the hikes, I had done incredible spreadsheets about nutrition and trying everything possible to pack as many calories as I could into a very compact space. What I didn't see coming was the joy that each little bit of food would be imbued with. And I came to appreciate everything for what every hamburger in town, every huckleberry.
What were you actually eating?
Well, you might say I ate my way from one end of the country to the other on a diet that would kill a goat. It came down to this equation about calories that I had to keep coming back to. The goal is to pack the most calories into the most dense package. Also, everything that can't survive a few days out in the desert sun, such as dairy products, they're out. So right from the start, no fresh food. You're going about 100 miles between these resupply points. So what it came down to for me was freeze-dried dinner entrees, a lot of beef jerky, more beef jerky than you would ever want to see in your lifetime. I was buying in bulk. Many pounds of dried apricots, dry roasted peanuts, pounds of Jelly Bellies, a lot of hard candies, and one Snickers bar per day. But, you know, by the twisted logic out there on the trail, it's actually a pretty healthy diet by hiker standards if you overlook the sodium. I mean, there was one man who looked at these same requirements and decided that the way to go was tubs of cake frosting, which he would consume two of per week. I have it on very good authority that he did not make it past Lake Tahoe on his trek north.
You talk about a group of you coming together, and you talk about roadkill. Can you tell us that story?
Well, just north of Walker Pass in Southern California, which is technically what the geologists would probably say is the end of the desert and the beginning of the Sierra Nevada,
mm-hmm.
I had noticed a freshly killed deer, and that was the first fresh meat I'd seen mm-hmm. in quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
I thought about it, didn't do anything, and a few minutes later, I came across a couple other hikers who I'd been sort of hopscotching with for days, and we were seriously considering backtracking, which is absolutely verboten in our little tribe. You just don't do that. But we were so hungry, we were thinking of heading south to go back, butcher the deer, and cook it. And so we started taking stock of all the tools that we had. And ultimately, since we all carry these teeny tiny little Swiss Army knives, and also the stoves that we carry are essentially cat food cans with a little piece of steel wool in the middle that you just pour denatured alcohol or gasoline antifreeze into. And they're only good for boiling two cups of water at a time. So we decided just on the basis of tools alone that we were going to have to table that motion.
David, you talk about your dinner on the trail, and it mm-hmm. became a ritual. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, dinner was the only segment of the day on any given day where I could really be still. So dinner became a special, almost sort of sacred time for meditation with me. And everything was based on boiling 2 cups of water on this tiny little cat food can stove. So I would have all my implements spread out before me in the dirt. And dinner never varied. Every night, the appetizer course was Jelly Bellies. The antipasto was beef jerky. And then there was the beautiful freeze-dried entree. And to me, it was the essence of comfort food because it was warm and it was there.
You just, you know, it's all in the eye of the beholder, isn't it? Context is everything.
Yes.
Hey, David, thank you.
Thanks, Lynn.
David Plotnikoff is a journalist in San Francisco. His article, Hungry Man, appeared in the June-July 2007 issue of Savoir magazine. Now, for David's guide to food and lodging on the Pacific Crest Trail, go to the website, splendidtable.org. From time to time this summer, we're checking in with food folk to find out which books they have on the nightstand and what they're taking with them to the beach. Ruth Reichel is editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine and hosts Gourmet's PBS show Diary of a Foodie. Ruth's joined us on the phone. Hey, Ruth, welcome.
It's great to be here.
So tell me, what are you looking at this summer for reading?
Well, I'm looking at a bunch of books which I should have read and haven't.
You're in good company.
For instance, in the food world, I have not read the new Alice Waters book, which is sitting there on my pile, glaring at me because I haven't read it yet. And I haven't read The United States of Arugula yet either, or Laura Shapiro's book on Julia Child, I admire everything Laura does. I can't wait to read On Chesil Beach, the new Ian McEwan book, and Michael Chabon's book, The Yiddish Policeman's Club.
I haven't seen that one yet.
Oh, well, he's such a wonderful writer. And this one, it's gotten great reviews. He imagines that instead of the Jews after World War II going to Israel, they go to Alaska.
And discover Copper River salmon. I mean,
exactly. And such locks it makes.
Yes, exactly. And you thought you knew all about locks. Let me tell you what really happened.
Exactly.
So what are you going to be cooking from, do you think?
Well, I'm partly going to be cooking from Russ Parsons' new book, How to Pick a Peach, because I don't think anybody writes better about the act of cooking.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, this is his look at produce. So it's exactly what you want to be cooking in the summer.
Yeah.
And I've started reading Chitrita Banerjee's book, Eating India. And it's making me very hungry for Indian food, which always seems right in the heat of the summer.
Right.
So I'm going back to Mater Joffrey and starting to cook my way through her book. And I expect I'm going to be doing that for much of the summer. I've also gotten the advance copy of Jonathan Waxman's new book, which I don't think comes out till the fall, but I'm cooking through it now. As I am, Sherry Yard has a new dessert book, which is wonderful.
These are some of the top chefs in the country, and their food's imaginative and exciting.
But what I love about these two books is that they're not chefy food. A third book that I've been cooking from a lot, and I expect that by the end of the summer I will have cooked my way through it, is Nancy Silverton's book, A Twist of the Wrist, which is perfect summer food because it's, you know, how to use the things you can buy in cans, the condiments, the Indian spices, frozen things, to make really good food.
Yeah.
And again, it's imaginative, you know, and it's food you want to eat.
Yeah, and that book, she has such a wonderful touch.
Exactly. And One of the things that I really love to do is listen to books on tape while I'm cooking. To me, it is the greatest pleasure in life. The two things I care about most.
Yeah.
And three books that I think are really great because the readers are so good is Middlesex, which the reader is just extraordinary. And The History of Love, which they've done it in three voices.
Oh.
So it's much less confusing than when you actually read the book. And Brideshead Revisited, which Jeremy Irons reads. And
oh.
I mean,
I'm sold.
And what could be more delicious? Listening to Brideshead Revisited and cooking from one of my really favorite books of the year, Nigel Slater's Kitchen Diaries.
Oh, yes.
So you're listening to this English accent and you're cooking this wonderful down-to-earth food from this wonderful English chef. It's my idea of heaven.
Mm. Ruth, thank you.
Thank you.
And have a fine summer.
I think I will. You too.
Ruth Reichel is editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine. Now, you can find her summer reading picks on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, we want to point out that you can now download podcasts of our entire program for free. So there is no reason to miss even a single week. We will accept no excuses. That's splendidtable.org. LA Times food and wine journalist Russ Parsons has been tracking American agriculture in his writings for over 20 years. What's equally impressive is that Russ cooks for his family nearly every night, which means that he sees the pragmatic side of how we live with food every day. Russ Parsons is author of How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. Russ, welcome.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here, Lynn. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. And you know, you cover how our produce gets to us, and you start with the plant in the field. And that's the big issue. But one of the things that I like that you do with this book is you talk about what we might call the smaller things, but very important ones, like refrigeration. What to refrigerate when you get home from the store or the market, or what not to refrigerate. And I have to say, when I looked at your list, I was kind of surprised. Can you give us an idea of how refrigeration works and what we should or should not put in there?
Well, I think a lot of times people tend to use refrigerators as storage places. When they get food home, it goes in the refrigerator so that it doesn't spoil. But with fruits and vegetables, it gets a little bit more complicated because there are some fruits and vegetables that you can actually ruin by refrigerating. First of all, there are a lot of things that just don't have to be refrigerated. Those tend to be things with very thick rinds, because what refrigeration does is slow down it slows down the spoiling process and the rate at which the fruits and vegetables give off primarily water. You know, that's why you put lettuce in the refrigerator, so that it doesn't go limp. When it's limp, it's given off all of its water. But there are other things that shouldn't be refrigerated for other kind of physiological reasons. I think the most surprising example is probably peaches and nectarines. Most people reflexively, you know, they'll go to the supermarket, they'll pick up a peach, which almost guaranteed is not going to be ripe, because
right.
ripe peaches at the supermarket turn into jam within 24 hours of people pawing through them.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got this underripe peach and they take it home and they stick it in the refrigerator. A couple days later, they pull it out and they bite into it and it's mealy and it's dry and
there's
no flavor. And they wonder, what did that store do to my peach? Well, you know, it probably wasn't the store at all. It was probably the refrigerator, because there's this thing that's called chill damage. And the stone fruit industry has spent millions of dollars trying to educate people about this. But it's still, even at retail level, even at the supermarket level, it still hasn't quite sunk through. It turns out that the temperature range of the home refrigerator is almost exactly the wrong temperature range to store underripe fruit at. It can be stored colder and it'll be fine,
uh-huh.
or it can be stored warmer and it will continue to ripen. But in that narrow range of the home refrigerator, what happens is it develops this chill damage and it results in kind of mealy, flavorless fruit. Another example like that is the tomato. I mean, I think that most people know a little bit better about refrigerating tomatoes, but I still go into grocery stores sometimes and I'll see the tomatoes stuck in the refrigerator.
Yeah.
Refrigerate a tomato, and it doesn't matter what happens, that tomato will never develop the kind of that ripe tomato flavor. With peaches, if you let the peach ripen at room temperature, at least then you can refrigerate it and it'll be fine. Just put them on the counter for a day or two. When they start to soften, when they start to smell great, I mean, that's the leading indicator. Go ahead and put them in a bag, and then you can put them in the refrigerator, and they'll be absolutely fine.
Okay,
but not before then.
Can you give us a quick list what never goes in the fridge?
There's a lot of things that never go in the fridge. You remember the jingle, right? Don't put your bananas in the refrigerator.
Right.
There's some surprising things. Like, for example, basil.
Huh.
If you put basil in the refrigerator, pay attention to it sometime. Basil turns black when it gets refrigerated for more than a day or two. If you'll just treat it like a cut flower, if you'll stick the stems in a glass of water and leave it at room temperature, it'll last much longer than it will in the refrigerator.
What else?
One that kind of surprises some people is potatoes. When a potato gets chilled, there are enzymes that start converting the starch in the potato to sugar. And if you leave a potato in the refrigerator for a couple of days, when you cook it, it'll actually taste sweet. It's a very eerie thing. And then there are things like just out of self-defense that you should never refrigerate, and that's onions and garlic and things like that. A refrigerator is a locked, sealed box. And if you put an onion in the refrigerator, pretty soon everything in that refrigerator is going to smell like an onion. The one exception to that is the sweet onions that we have so many of now, the Vidalias, the Mauis, regular brown onions have this very strong acid that acts to preserve them. It's that thing that gives onions their bite.
Right.
These sweet onions are bred so that they don't have that acid in it, and they're also not cured the way brown onions are. So you need to keep those in the refrigerator. The good news is that since they're so low in that acid, they don't have the strong aromas either, which is why you can eat them like apples.
Well, now that I have a revelation about basil, hey, Russ, thank you.
Thanks so much, Lynn.
Russ Parsons is author of How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. Now, he left us with a recipe that includes a great retro dressing. It's new potato and green bean salad with green goddess dressing. Find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, who first dared to allow grocery store customers to help themselves to goods? And when did it happen? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Room & Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted, American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, who first dared to allow grocery store customers to help themselves to goods, and when did it happen? Well, it was Clarence Saunders in 1916. He opened his first Piggly Wiggly store in Memphis. Russ Parsons writes about this in How to Pick a Peach. Up until Clarence, a clerk got the goods for you. It was a very daring move. I mean, to allow customers to wander on their own and actually touch the goods, and it worked. Piggly Wiggly is still going strong. Now, the actual supermarket was first done by Michael Cullen. He started the King Cullen stores in the New York area in 1930, and they were huge for those days, a vast 6,000 square feet. And today, that's a mere postage stamp. The average supermarket now measures 50,000 square feet. It's about the size of a football field. And it's filled with creations that would have had Cullen's head spinning. But his marketing technique is still going strong, at least in some quarters. He said, pile it high, sell it low.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me.
It's time for your calls, brought to you by Sweet Leaf Sweetener, the new all-natural sweetener alternative at sweetleaf.com. Okay, guys, get to those phones. The number is 800-537-5252. Let's see, we have Brian on the line from Texas. Hey, Brian, what do you want to talk about?
Oh, good morning. I'm so happy to be on your show, Lynn. Thank you.
Well, thanks for calling.
My question is, you know, when you go to dinner parties and the food is always served, at least when I go, from the left, and then the plates are taken away on the right. And I was asked this question, why it's done that way, and I didn't have the answer. And I'd really love to know if you do.
Okay, this gets us into one of my favorite areas, which is dining history.
Yes.
And I'll try not to do the 30-minute diatribe. But by the way, I'm going to speculate about the answer. Let me preface everything by saying that.
Right.
But first, the thing that I always find so interesting is that we Western peoples, so the people of Europe and the people of the Americas, believe it or not, we did not start serving food that way until the early to the mid-1800s. And, it was called Russian service.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
You know about this.
I do, because recently I found out that sort of, or at least I understood that family style in a way was more a French way of serving, but
That's
the
right.
Russians were more formal in serving by courses.
And all of Europe ate that way in the sense that the food was very formally laid out.
Right.
But it was all set out on the table at once. And there may have been courses, but those courses would have involved many different dishes. And
right.
you helped yourself, or your servant went around the table to get you things that you couldn't reach for. So this idea
right.
of passing food, of setting down a plate and having, you know, food that was passed around was a relatively new idea. This is my theory about that, because I've wondered about it as well. I think because the majority of the population is right-handed, it is easiest when you are serving yourself from that platter that is presented to you on your left, it is easiest for you to reach over and help yourself from it with your right hand if it's presented on the left. If it were presented on the right, you it would not be very graceful, and you would not be able to have the, you know, the full reach of your arm. And I think that's the reason. And as far as the removal, I'm not sure why that removal is done in that way, but maybe it's just the idea of having some sort of balance.
Right. Well, you know, and I think you're very right about the whole business of when the platter is on your left side and if you're right-handed, because I've watched people at the table who are left-handed, and it's very difficult for them. Anyhow, it was just something. I hate not knowing the answer to something.
We share that. It's so frustrating.
And I just think your show is so brilliant, and every time I listen, you give such good advice. And, you know, when I told my friends I might be on your show, they were like, oh, my God, Lynn, with the voice. Your voice is just so unmistakable, and we love it.
Brian, I'm officially blushing, as is everyone in the control room. And for everyone, I say thank you for the kind words.
Thank you for taking my question.
Well, it's
Bye.
A good question. And, you know, I'm going to go home and research it some more.
I'm going to do the same, I think. Thanks.
You take care, Brian.
You too. Bye.
800-537-5252. Let's see, who is up next? We have got David calling from Miami. David, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I was going to talk about a great interview with a gentleman about terroir.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And the seeming mystery of terroir sparked another mystery that I had in the food world, something called umami.
Oh, yes.
Something I hear about and don't entirely understand, and I'm hoping you can give me some insights.
I'm not a scientist, but I'll tell you what I know.
Okay.
Umami is sometimes referred to as the fifth taste. You know, the four basic tastes are bitter, sour, salt, and sweet. But there's no accounting for that kind of savoriness that you get out of food. Red meat has it. Soy sauce has it. Parmigiano Reggiano cheese has it.
Mushrooms maybe even?
Yes, exactly.
Uh-huh.
And
okay.
Evidently, this is umami. And it's referred to as umami, at least in Japan. And what it actually is this savory taste that's imparted by glutamate that exists in certain foods and certain substances, and then another collection of substances that I can't remember the name of, but it's the combination of those two that just happen to exist. And a lot of times they exist in things that are fermented. For instance, Asian fish sauce and soy sauce have umami. Red wine has umami. And it's that's where the idea of monosodium glutamate comes from, that it started being manufactured to broaden, to open up flavors. But it turns out that it naturally exists. Shiitake mushrooms have it. I'm trying to think. Pork has it. Tomatoes are loaded with it. And I think it's one of the reasons why tomatoes are so irresistible to most of us.
Now, has the food community at large sort of grasped this as really the fifth element?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's so much research being done now. For instance, there's some research done in Dijon, France, that tells us fat should be the sixth flavor, that fat itself is not just something you feel in your mouth and react to that texture and that appeal perhaps of it, but there's also a flavor component there. But the thing that's interesting about umami, and this is why cooks have jumped on it with, you know, both feet, is that it tends to enlarge the flavor of other things, which is, and for me personally, I cannot tell you what vindication this is, because in writing two books about food in Italy, I talked about Parmigiano-Reggiano cheese and how it seemed to be almost unique in that when you added Parmigiano to a dish, it wasn't that you tasted the Parmigiano, it's that it seemed to enhance and bring up the character of everything around it. Well, guess what? It's loaded with umami. So what I was sensing, and a lot of other people were, I wasn't, you know, alone in this, was actually a scientific fact, and tomatoes are the same thing. You know, tomatoes were the poor man's wonder because they brought, for a meager amount of meat or a handful of beans or wild greens that cost you nothing, you added tomatoes and you got this enlargement of flavor and you got a lushness on the palate that was so satiating. And they were cheap to grow. Well, they're packed with umami. And what the trick now, we've just finished writing a book that's coming out next spring, and we talk about this. The trick now is a lot of chefs, for instance, keep fish sauce in their refrigerators. You know, the Asian fish sauce that smells like old socks. But the reality is you put a few drops of that into an oil and vinegar dressing. You put a little teeny bit of it into, you know, a fabulous pot roast or into a deglazing of the pan, you know, to make a pan sauce for something. You'll never know it's there. But it's so packed with umami, it's going to enlarge everything else.
Wow.
So you see, a little bit of these things are things that can really take up all of the flavor in a dish and can make everything else better. So that's
interesting.
Yeah, isn't it? And
it really is.
Yeah, because it's fascinating, because this explains so much about why, for instance, Asian food, especially things as simple, as stripped down to the essentials as Japanese cuisine can be so satiating. And it's all about this idea of chemical substances that naturally exist in foods that enhance flavors.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's pretty marvelous.
Well, you've sure cleared up an obscure food term and a couple of little arguments I was having around the dinner table.
Well, you know, I think, you know, this is why you keep a little soy sauce. You keep a little, you know, you keep a little of this stuff around and you'll be amazed.
Is the fish sauce that you mentioned, is that available?
Yes, yes. It's called
that you would encourage people to make?
Yeah. No. You can't make it. It's a fermented fish sauce. Or if you did, you'd have to move out of your house. It's a very, very ancient way of preserving fish. And you'll find it in Asian stores. And it will come from Vietnam or from Thailand. And one of the brands to look for, you don't have to know the name of it, it has three crabs on the label. And it's not very expensive. A 3/4 of a quart bottle is going to cost you $4. I store it in the refrigerator. You use very little of it. But because when you smell it, you'll see why. But the reality is that smell and that strength goes away in some way, and then everything else gets bigger. But start out just like an eighth of a teaspoon the next time you make an oil and vinegar dressing and see what happens. Okay. Hey, thank you.
Thank you so much.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. There's a new food magazine, and it's not just another collection of recipes and peppy introductions, at least from what I've seen so far. It's called Meat Paper, and its creators are Sasha Wisansky and Amy Standen. And Sasha joins us. Sasha, welcome.
Thank you.
So what is Meat Paper?
Meat Paper is a non-food food magazine.
Meaning?
And I say that because what we're trying not to do is cover meat in the way that the food magazines already do. We're creating an interdisciplinary approach to look at it from all angles.
So give me for instance.
For example, we're extremely interested in how artists use meat in their work, either as a medium or a subject.
Now, meat as an artist medium, as in what kinds of things?
Well, we have an idea that meat has actually been a consistent topic in the history of art. You see meat-related artworks from all periods and all regions.
Huh.
But in contemporary art in particular, a lot of artists are representing meat or actually using the meat itself. In our upcoming issue, we're publishing a self-portrait by the artist Vic Muniz, which he created in ground beef.
That's fascinating.
It's a wonderful piece.
So why did you pick meat?
Well, we really feel that meat is more than food. And when I say that, I mean that people don't just think of it as something good to eat or even mm-hmm. as something not to eat.
Mm-hmm.
They think of it as something much more profound and representing their feelings about culture or themselves. It's a very complicated topic.
So when you look for articles, what kinds of things are you looking for? Obviously, you're not just going to chefs or professional cooks.
Exactly. Well, I can run down some of the content that we...
Sure, I'd love it.
Yeah. Issue Zero. We published a large 2-page spread image of a world map carved in Spam by a San Francisco artist named Mike Arcega, which is a really incredible piece. And he's really interested in how Spam was an American World War II military ration and became disseminated around the world and somehow became part of all of these regional cuisines. So he's looking at Spam as a symbol of American cultural conquest around the world.
What about writers? What kinds of articles?
We have a whole range of articles. Actually, one of the articles that we're going to be publishing in an upcoming issue is an investigation of the flavor umami and how it may or may not be present in meat. So that's sort of an investigative piece. You hear the word umami a lot.
Yeah, you do. You do.
But we found that people don't really understand what that is, and it's often associated with meat. So we asked a journalist to look into that topic. We're publishing poetry. We're hoping to have one poem in every issue. Lots of journalism. Actually, several anthropologists have been assigned as well.
Any reaction yet from the vegetarians?
Well, we're really hoping not to alienate vegetarians. And what's been really interesting about this process is that people assume that we're either pro-meat or anti-meat. And we're actually more interested in asking questions about what meat is, why people are interested in it, why people either choose to eat it or choose not
mm-hmm.
to. So to us, vegetarianism is a really big part of the story.
Well, we wish you good luck.
Well, thank you very much.
And thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Sasha Wisansky is co-creator of the magazine Meat Paper. Now, for more information, go to the website splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, the answering machine loves people checking in. So call it and us at 800-537-5252. Have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Jim Dent. He said, "A perfect summer day is when the sun is shining, the breeze is blowing, the birds are singing, and the lawnmower is broken." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room & Board. Handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Information on everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Not only will you find invaluable newsletters and podcasts, you will find information on our new book, How to Eat Supper, Recipes, Stories, and Opinions. It's a collection of some of our favorite no-fail recipes, trenchant tips, as well as stories and advice from some of our favorite guests. Check it all out, splendidtable.org. Our show is brought to you in part by Sweet Leaf Sweetener, America's new zero-calorie, zero-carb, zero-glycemic index alternative to sugar and artificial sweeteners. Sweet like sugar and is 100% natural at grocers everywhere or online at sweetleaf.com. And by gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about food menus and cooking at gather.com. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau and intern Andrew Schumacher. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. Have a great week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.